Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Johanna Kolajewski at Keene State College. For A Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, Trevor Immelman is participating in his first PGA event since winning the Masters, and it hasn't been pretty. The South African is 7 over par headed down the stretch during first-round play at the Byron Nelson Championship. The Oakland A's have signed Frank Thomas 4 days after the 39-year-old designated hitter was cut by Toronto for complaining about a reduction in playing time. The Big Hurt is batting cleanup this afternoon against the visiting Minnesota Twins. Even without injured MVP Alex Rodriguez, the New York Yankees are on the verge of their first three-game sweep of the season. The Yankees look to complete their first sweep at U.S. Cellular Field in nearly 6 years when they meet the White Sox tonight. The Sox will try to avoid losing three straight for the first time this season. The Chicago Cubs will try for their seventh straight win when they wrap up a two-game stop at Colorado. The Cubs are tied with Arizona for the league's best record, thanks largely to their high-scoring offense. Chicago leads the majors with 133 runs and has scored at least seven in each of the last five. And the St. Louis Cardinals have fallen to 13-9 this season. They'll try to avoid losing a third straight game when they take on the Pittsburgh Pirates tonight. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Coming in June, Summer Jazz Festival 2008, featuring the University of Illinois Jazz faculty with Lizanne Lyons, Jim Pugh, and Chip McNeil. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:42. The death of Emmett Till helped spark the civil rights movement, but he was more than an icon. The play called The Ballad of Emmett Till presents Till as a typical teenager. The piece draws on the memories of some of Till's childhood friends and family. Illinois Public Radio's Lynette Kalsness has this report.
It's not every day that actors get to meet the characters they're playing, but that happened recently at the Goodman Theater. Playwright Aoife Baeza introduces the actors to Emmett Till's family and friends.
Emmett, I want you to meet one of your childhood playmates.
Oh, hi, it's so nice to meet you.
Joseph Bird.
I'm Joseph. And what's your name?
Anita Cochran.
It's so nice to meet you.
I remember him from the playground and from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. He was a nice-looking kid, of course, mm-hmm. And he kind of flirted a lot. So that's why he was so popular.
Right.
Till, of course, has become a symbol of the civil rights movement. But in this play, he's just like every other teenage boy. That's how one of his cousins, Heloise Woods Aldridge, remembers Till, whose nickname was Bobo or Bo.
We'd all be sitting waiting to see what Bo's going to do next, you know. And they had what they call a victory garden across the street from my great-grandmother's house. And he would go out in the garden and get little garden snakes and put them in his pocket, come back in and scare all of us kids. We'd be running all over the place. That's the type of person he was. He was a fun, loving person.
He liked the girls, but especially Aldridge.
My husband today had a picture of me. And he would sell that picture to Bo and then steal it back and sell it to him again. Everybody just wanted to be in his company.
Grade school classmate Carol Adkins remembers Till liking lots of girls.
I had a very good girlfriend of mine that he really liked. And I remember him going over to the school store and putting a penny in the gumball machine and getting a ring out for her. It was a plastic ring.
This is a class that he should have come out in.
Adkins pulls out a laminated picture of her elementary school graduating class from 1956. Till would never graduate. In the summer of 1955, he begged his mother to visit family in Mississippi, an argument relived in the play.
I go to Argo by myself, go downtown Chicago to pay and store bills by myself, to do the rest of this laundry by myself.
Mississippi is not downtown, it's down south.
Hurt soul
to another place. Really? You don't speak unless you're spoken to, and you
I
say
already
yes,
do
sir,
that.
Yes,
I know how to be polite.
I'm not talking about that. When if a white woman even approaches, you have to move off the sidewalk.
You're serious?
I'm very serious. You do not look at them.
The more raised in the culture, he had no idea.
Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. was Till's cousin who went to Mississippi with Till.
They didn't want him to come because, you know, they knew that the way he liked jokes and fun, he could get in trouble. They were afraid of what did happen. They were afraid it could have happened.
And what did happen was the story that most people know. Till whistled at a white storekeeper's wife, and 4 days later, a group of men came for him in the middle of the night.
And man, there was terror. That's when the terror began in me, because they didn't tell me about how they do people. And I hear him talking about that he got a fat boy from Chicago. My heart started shaking. And you couldn't, it was so dark, see, you couldn't even see your hand before your face. I could just feel somebody's fixing to die. And I'm saying, I'm fixing to die, that's what I said.
Parker lived. Till's mutilated body was found in the river. Till's cousin, Heloise Woods Aldridge, remembers hearing the news.
I was afraid to go to sleep at night. A lot of times I didn't sleep. I would sit up in my bed with the light on, and it took a while before I could really just put it to rest.
Despite the horrific end to Till's young life, the play's director, Oz Scott, says there's also lots of joy in the piece.
One of the things I try to keep stressing is that some people say, I don't know if I want to come see a play about Emmett Till. It's such a horrible story. But the story is, this boy was 14 years on this world, and it was 14 years of life and fun and prankster.
Emmett speaks louder in death than he would if he had lived.
Again, Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr.
So a lot of things happened. A lot of good came out of it. A lot of people gave their lives through the years, and we don't want to waste that. We don't want him to die in vain.
Racism is still a problem today, and Parker says we need to know history or risk repeating it. The Ballad of Emmett Till opens with previews on Saturday. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
The Illinois Board of Higher Education took a different approach this year when submitting a budget request to the governor and state legislature. The board laid out 5 different funding levels, showing how each would impact colleges and universities. But the governor's spending plan would fund higher education at a flat rate. The institutions say without more money, tuition will continue to rise dramatically. Illinois Public Radio's Sean Crawford spoke with board chair Carrie Heitman about budgeting for higher ed.
In coming up with this concept, this new way of making our budget recommendation, an important factor is that we, as the board, do not determine revenue sources. It's not our role. We have no role in deciding how much revenue is made available to higher education. What our role is to use our expertise to advise the governor and the General Assembly on how best to invest scarce state resources to yield returns on state priorities in higher education. Okay, so we kept that in mind. And so we put together a proposal that set forth five different levels. The first level was the base. Okay, so it's the current year without the legislative add-ons, as they're called. The second level was one that was requested by the governor's office to have a 1% increase in there. We never supported the 1% increase. We didn't say that's where we were. We certainly didn't say the base was what we think we should have for the next fiscal year. But you have to have a starting point, and you have to have sound information upon which to build to the higher levels. And then we added a few other increased levels, and we showed for each increase what you would get, where you'd spend the money. It almost provides a cafeteria-style approach to funding higher ed. So you might not go with our Step 5 totally. You might not go with Step 4 totally, but you can take a piece of Step 5, a piece of Step 4. You can mix and match the programs. The bottom line of what we set forth is, for the first time under this governor, we actually told the legislature and the governor, how to invest additional levels of funds in higher education.
Realizing that the governor and the lawmakers really do come up with the money, and you're really just making that request, was it a mistake, though, to offer the lower amounts, like the 1% that you said came from the governor's office? Was that a mistake to do that because it could give some the opinion that maybe the board would go along with that approach?
First of all, no and no. I don't think it was a mistake, and I don't think anybody who's knowledgeable on higher education issues for a moment believes that this board supports base or 1% levels. We have been very clear in everything we've said publicly why those levels were in there, and that our position is not to support any particular level, and clearly we'd rather have more than less. So no, and I think, you know, there's, you got to make compromises and you got to provide the kind of information that the decision makers require. And if they, you know, if GOMB felt that it needed that information, I'm not going to not give it to them. That'd be foolish. And it'd be counterproductive, I think. But, you know, you got to look at the whole, the entirety of the message here. And you got to look at what we've clearly said. And what we've clearly said is we're at a crossroads. If we don't make a decision that higher education is a priority for the state, then we're going to get to the point where we're not going to have the quality higher education system that all of us, I really believe, feel we need here in the state.
Some of the individual universities have come out now and offered up, I guess, what you would call a revised budget plan for their individual campuses. Does that hurt the board's position in some way when trying to keep this this dialogue going with lawmakers and the governor's office for everybody to suddenly be coming out with different numbers and putting those out there at a time when the budget is in a state of flux?
I don't think it hurts. I think the more information, the better. I think what hurts the process more is people being unwilling to say what they really believe and to provide the kind of information that is necessary for sound policy making and for sound decision making. By the way, you know, we didn't do this in a vacuum. The board worked with the presidents of the major 4 years here, and we talked through what our plan was, and we took input from them on how we should, you know, move forward. And we said, we need your support on this. You know, this is something that will be, this new approach will be beneficial to your institutions, right, because we'll be more of an advocate than we have been in the past, which I think is important and necessary. And so we worked with them in advance of coming up with this proposal, and then we had to work with the governor's office to explain what we were doing and to, you know, try to meet the needs of all the stakeholders as we sort of broke out of our shell, so to speak.
Of course, some of the news that's going on now is the governor's office is talking about a budget deficit overall in the state and ways to possibly shore up the state's budget situation. And part of that is possibly apparently withholding money from some universities as we move at the end of this fiscal year or maybe into next fiscal year. Does that change anything with this whole budget approach that the board has taken when we're talking now about funding levels that may not even be met in the current fiscal year?
Well, I mean, it would certainly be a disappointment if there weren't the funds available that we understood would be available for this year. On the other hand, there's obviously a severe economic problem going on in the state and in the country, and something that could not have been predicted, I don't believe, when the budget was created. And, you know, like I said, it's not our role as the IBHE to find a revenue source or to dictate how much revenue is made available to the higher education institutions in the state of Illinois. And so what we've done as we've heard this news is provided an opportunity for the administration to explain to campus leadership directly what the problems are. And we've notified grant recipients that the fiscal outlook for this year is becoming increasingly more grim. And that's all we can do. I mean, we don't create revenue. We don't decide revenue issues. And are we pleased? Obviously not. But all we can do is what we can do here. And does it bode well for the 09 fiscal year budget? You know, it obviously raises some issues for me, but the jury's still out on that. I think, and you know, I look at the higher education portion of the budget issue. That's our responsibility. That's what I focus on, okay? And I say, you know, we're seeing a lot of support for the new role that IBHE has played in the budget process. I know the governor's office supports this, but their job and the legislature's job, unlike our job at IBHE, is to balance a lot of competing, valid, important, you know, concerns. My job is to worry about higher education.
Carrie Heitman chairs the Illinois Board of Higher Education. She spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Sean Crawford.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and we are coming to your town. Well, kind of. We're actually trying something that no other public radio show has ever tried. We're putting on a live show and sending it out in high definition via satellite into hundreds of movie theaters across the country live. It'll be stories and outtakes from the brand new season of our television show. I'll perform a radio story, answer audience questions. Thursday, May 1st. For tickets, visit this station's website or thisamericanlife.org.
More information at will.illinois.edu.
Earth and Sky.
What we're doing is developing a new nanoparticle-based vaccine that you can put in the nose with a nose dropper, a simple device.
You're listening to James Baker, director of the Michigan Nanotechnology Institute for Medicine and the Biological Sciences. He's talking about new vaccines made with nanotechnology. One big advantage is that nanovaccines can keep up to 3 months without refrigeration.
You can imagine being able to take one vial of vaccine out to a community that's very remote, not have to worry about refrigerating it, and then taking a simple nose dropper and administering it to the whole population at one time.
Baker explained that oil and water-based nanoparticles, only 1/200th the width of a human hair, are small enough to seep into your immune system through the mucous membranes of your nose. Baker is working to develop nanovaccines for smallpox, and he said he's optimistic about a future vaccine for HIV. Our thanks to Dr. James Baker, who is part of a Fred Friendly seminar called Nanotechnology, The Power of Small, on public television in 2008. Visit powerofsmall.org. This is Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Celebration, a festival of the arts, April 25th, 26th, and 27th at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. Celebration features 3 days of art, music, food, and fun with special guest Dr. Ralph Stanley and his Clinch Mountain Boys.
You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine. We're wrapping up The Afternoon Magazine. The World is coming up next at 3 o'clock. Tomorrow on The Afternoon Magazine, in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be Christopher Normant. He is a professor of environmental science and biology at the State University of New York College at Brockport. We will talk with him tomorrow about birds. He is the author of Return to Warden's Grove, Science, Desire, and the Lives of Sparrows. He'll join us tomorrow afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana, prepared by meteorologist Ed Kieser. This afternoon in western Illinois, cloudy with periods of rain and thunderstorms. In eastern Illinois and western Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms. In eastern Indiana, mostly sunny this afternoon. Highs ranging from 67 in northwestern Illinois to 84 in far southern Indiana. Tonight in Illinois and in western Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. In eastern Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy with a few scattered showers arriving after midnight. Lows ranging from 56 in northeastern Indiana to 63 in southwestern Illinois. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun, windy and warm with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Highs ranging from near 70 in northwestern Illinois to 83 in the far south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly cloudy, windy and warm with the chance of a few showers and thunderstorms. The high 78. Tonight, mostly cloudy, breezy and mild with occasional showers and thunderstorms. The low 62. The outlook for tomorrow, intervals of clouds and sunshine, windy and warm with a few showers and thunderstorms. The high tomorrow, 78. The outlook for tomorrow night, cloudy with rain and thunderstorms during the evening, then becoming partly cloudy after midnight, turning cooler. The low tomorrow night, 45. And then the outlook for Saturday, mostly sunny, the high, 66. It's 76 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Coming up on 3 o'clock, The World from PRI is next. Don't go away.